From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. This evening, President Trump takes his case for a border wall to primetime TV and radio. The address at 6 p.m. our time is expected to include the claim that a humanitarian and security crisis exists on the U.S.-Mexico border. Funding for the wall is the central disagreement, keeping the federal government partially shut down. We'll have the latest for you right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a good start. Coming up, what its supporters call the Green New Deal and its call for a 70% federal tax rate on income above $10 million a year. A lot of different programs that its supporters say that revenue would fund. What effect might that rate have on overall tax revenues and the U.S. economy? We'll talk about that later this hour. But first, this evening at 6 our time, President Trump will address the nation. He's expected to make his case for border wall funding, citing what he calls a humanitarian and security crisis along the U.S.-Mexico border. Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer will deliver a joint response. We'll bring you NPR's live coverage of both speeches here on KPCC, 6 o'clock this evening. This morning, Vice President Mike Pence gave interviews to the network morning news shows. On NBC's Today, the VP was asked whether the president will declare events at the border a national emergency.
What I expect the president will do tonight is explain to the American people that we have a humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border. 60,000 people are now attempting to come into our country illegally every month. That's more than 2,000 a day. But what's unique about it, Hallie, and why the Washington Post has even called it a bona fide emergency, is because the vast majority of those people now are families and unaccompanied children, and it simply is overwhelming the ability of our Customs and Border Patrol.
Steph Kite, politics and demographics reporter for Axios, has been closely following the story. Steph, thank you for joining us. Share with us in a bit more detail what the president is expected to argue tonight and what the White House's hopes are for his national address.
We are certainly expecting the president to make a strong case for why his wall should be funded and built at the border. He'll likely be citing lots of numbers about the increased numbers of immigrants who have been crossing the border and coming to the U.S. border. But, of course, it's important to look at those high numbers in the context of the past several years. And while there has been a rise in migrants at the border, there have also been increases in the past that are similar. Even Obama faced his own migrant crisis in 2014. But we're going to definitely see the president continue to stress that this is a crisis and that there needs to be something done about this, and using that as a reason to build his wall and convince Democrats to sign off on funding for it.
Well, and is one of the factors the president is expected to touch on that there are so many people seeking asylum in the United States that it's overwhelming the immigration detention centers?
It certainly is an issue, and there has been a large increase in asylum seekers applying for asylum to the U.S. in the past few years, and it started shortly before Trump took office, but has continued to this day. But one interesting thing about the border wall is that a border wall wouldn't prevent someone from using their legal ability to apply for asylum. That is a legal process of coming to the U.S. The border wall would more prevent people from entering illegally, which is a route some people tend to take when they want to apply for asylum. But it will still be possible to apply for asylum at ports of entry.
We're talking with Steph Kite, Axios reporter. And what's the American public's view on a border wall? What does polling indicate?
Overall, especially among Trump voters are in favor of the wall. But overall, many people are skeptical that it would be effective at really helping this migrant crisis that we're seeing today. But it is an important issue for Trump voters, and that's why I think we're seeing the president double down on this on Twitter and in this speech tonight. We'll expect him to continue to campaign for this. It's something that he promises voters in the beginning, and this could be one of his last chances to really fulfill that promise.
And the Democratic response, we've been hearing from the Democratic leaders, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, over the past several days. There were the meetings last Friday at the White House in an effort to find some sort of a compromise. Do we anticipate there would be additional arguments that they would make tonight, or would tonight expected to be a consolidation of the arguments they've been making for the past several days?
The Democrats have made it pretty clear that they're unwilling to provide any funding for the president's wall. They've suggested funding the rest of the government except for DHS and figuring out the wall issue later, but they haven't really budged on this issue. I think Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to start her term as speaker caving to something like the president's border wall. It's become a very political issue when immigration already is a very political an emotional issue. It's why Congress hasn't passed any immigration reform for more than 30 years. But I think we're going to expect Democrats to really double down on their stance that they're not going to cave to the president's demands for a border wall.
And if it isn't called a border wall and additional dollars are conceded by Democrats, those in D.C. that think those would be the terms of a potential compromise, that the president could declare victory that he got more for border security and Democrats could declare victory that they didn't build a border wall?
Yes, that's certainly a possibility. It's something we've seen in the past 2 years where there have been funds allocated for border security, but they're specifically not to be used for building a new border wall. It can be used to create fencing that's similar to what already exists at some areas on the border. But it's a question whether the president will settle for that, whether he will call that a triumph and say that the wall is being built, or whether he's going to demand more than that.
Thank you so much, Steph. Good to talk with you today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Steph Kite is politics and demographics reporter for Axios. Also with us, Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent Jess Braven. He's been writing about the legality of an emergency order from the president, which could take funding from other government departments to be used toward building a border wall or beefing up the physical infrastructure of the U.S.-Mexico border. Jess, thank you for being with us. What are the competing legal arguments here?
Well, you know, there have been emergencies declared by presidents over the centuries. In the 70s, the Congress took some action to regulate when emergencies are declared and when they expire, and to put some level of supervision over them. But they did not take a step of defining what an emergency is. So we may see a case really where, for the first time, there'll be a dispute over whether the border situation that the president considers so urgent qualifies as an emergency. And there are some, we heard Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, say earlier this week that that would be a likely point of dispute the president try to invoke emergency powers. There's some background on what an emergency is. There were some Supreme Court cases decades ago. There was a Congressional Research Service report which gave a few definitions of what an emergency would be, published about 10 years ago. But there isn't really a definitive court statement, and it's unclear whether a court would want to second guess a president's judgment about what is an emergency. But the next step might be more disputed, which is, okay, if it is an emergency, is the president acting lawfully? Because Congress has granted the president all kinds of powers that he doesn't normally have when there is a declared emergency. And what many lawyers are looking at is a section of federal law that gives the president power to reallocate military construction funds if there is a declaration of war or a proclamation of national emergency, and whether the conditions in that statute that let him move around or take money from projects that have been approved and use them for an unapproved project to respond to the emergency, that might be an area where we see some litigation.
All right. And so what you, if I'm hearing you correctly, the president cannot just unilaterally take money from a military construction project and say, OK, now we're going to put that towards U.S.-Mexico barrier. There would have to be an emergency declaration to allow a president to do that.
That's right, because the principal power that the Congress has under the constitutional system is what they call the power of the purse. It decides, you know, what taxes to impose and how to spend the proceeds, and there are specific things that it has powers to do, provide for the national defense and so forth. So Congress likes to be quite particular when it allocates money, and it has decides on which projects it wants to fund. Not all that money in that military construction budget, though, has been spent, and it's the money that's not spent, or at least not yet allocated, that that the president can move around if it is a declared emergency. Of course, he's taking money from projects that have been approved that the Pentagon, in many instances, probably really, really wants, and moving it to this new project, which there's no money for, and if he takes $5 billion out of that account, as he's suggested he thinks is necessary, that would leave about $7 billion. So it's, a very, very substantial amount. It would basically mean a major halt to other military construction projects, across the country or around the world.
We're talking with Jess Braven, who's Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. So if the president decides to make the declaration either in his speech tonight or subsequently, what would you anticipate would be the first legal challenge to that? Would it be a filing in federal court? Would it be a petition to the Supreme Court? What would be the most likely action?
I think most likely would be, well, one, the House of Representatives itself, now that the opposition party, the Democrats control it, they would be able to decide that they want to, litigate themselves, and they would have a, argument that their powers are being usurped or something of that sort. And they would go to, I think almost certainly that the petition would begin in federal court and would argue all these things. It's not an emergency. He's just using it as a pretext to get around the normal constitutional structure. Even if it is an emergency, a wall is not the kind of military project that was anticipated and for which it's been used before, like during combat operations in Afghanistan and so on, where things happen before you can get through the normal appropriation process. So those arguments would come up, and obviously the government would respond that the president is entitled to almost complete deference when he deals with national security, and he's the commander in chief and needs to decide what projects the military needs. And those are areas that courts really don't like to get into because they don't feel they have the expertise the way the political branches do. So they may not want to get in on it. On the other hand, this president has been very aggressive in asserting legal powers, and courts have responded with perhaps giving him less benefit of the doubt than more modest presidents in prior years have received.
Thank you so much, Jess. Appreciate your laying out the legal issues involved should President Trump declare it an emergency. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Jess Braven, Wall Street Journal, Supreme Court correspondent. Also with us, NPR media correspondent and the host of the NPR News and Culture show On Point, David Folkenflik. David, good to have you with us. And first of all, the networks had to make a determination whether they would carry the president's primetime address tonight and whether they would carry a Democratic response. NPR is carrying both tonight. We'll have it 6 o'clock right here on KPCC. What goes into that decision-making?
Well, it's interesting. You didn't see the networks come out right away and say, yeah, you betcha we'll do it. They had to think it through. I talked to one broadcast news executive who was involved in these decisions, and he said it was not a slam dunk by any stretch. And in normal circumstances, it would be. You'd say this is the president of the United States requesting, they call it a formal request, but saying, look, we hereby request time to be able to address the nation directly on a matter of, we think, is transcending importance. is the first request that, that Trump has made from the Oval Office to address the nation in this way. And you'd think normally it would happen. The problem is that it's pretty evident the president is not going to make a major announcement. Often these moments are done in times of true national crisis. Oftentimes they involve, you know, the announcement of sending of troops on military endeavors or the financial crisis under Obama or other like things, the Hurricane Katrina for George W. Bush. In this case, the president is citing what they are now calling the humanitarian and national security crisis at our southern border, but also the shutdown. And that is actually what seems to have convinced the broadcast networks they needed to do it, that they were the federal government is in a shutdown. It is going to be, as of the end of this week, I think the longest one in decades. And it's an important issue to address. They just are wary. They're wary because, as I said, that they think there will be nothing new in this and that will make this essentially a political argument being made by the president. And they're also, you know, the enormous elephant in the room, if you will, is the fact that the president is so inclined to offer accounts that are errant, are estranged from the truth, and sometimes clearly intentionally misleading and deceitful, and that in a live address, particularly one where they have not received the text in advance as they would for the State of the Union address, in a live address like this, they cannot provide any form of fact-checking in real time. That is, they have to wait until after he's done talking to provide a counterpoint or factual analysis. And you know, every president, before I end this little element, every president, you know, shades, every president spins, every president has probably misled and deceived the public in some way or another. What this president does is different. His relationship with the truth is not even agnostic, but it is often quite hostile. And therefore, you know, you have a question of whether or not you're in the business of deceiving the public, even as you're allowing the president of the United States to talk directly to them.
Of course, the counterargument to that would be that the American people elected him. And so the argument would be, well, he's earned the right to address the public, even if what he's saying is misleading and incorrect.
Well, I think first off, I think a lot of people mistake the idea of live coverage for coverage. That is, you're not required by law to carry him directly to the public in the moment at which he's speaking. You could delay it 5-10 minutes and say, okay, we're going to fact check. And, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners remember pop-up videos on VH1 or Mystery Science Theater, but you could have people sort of,
left-hand side.
Right. You could have people on the left third of the screen typing up captions saying, you know, claim president says or administration claims 4,000 people intercepted at borders on national security suspect or watch lists. And in fact, only 6 of them were encountered. I think it was in the first 6 months or something of 2018 at the southern border. The vast majority of such people are indicted at not at the border, actually, but at the airports, and that actually there are more concerns of people being caught at the northern border, but you don't hear much about that in terms of people coming in from Canada. Now, there are legitimate problems and issues in terms of the southern border. That's not in any way dismissed that, but there's a tough relationship that journalists have. They are not merely a megaphone or a bulletin board on which the president gets to tack things. On the other hand, there is something useful, just as you say, in allowing people to hear the president in his own words address the public directly and then coming at it.
And in this case, there will be a joint Democratic response from Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. So presumably they're going to have a team there listening to what the president has to say. And it'll be an instant response pointing out what they believe to be any falsehoods or mischaracterizations that he makes along the way. Do you know from NPR's standpoint, was this a difficult call for the radio network?
You know, I'm looking to find out more information about our network. I don't speak for management, and they don't always consult me on such matters. But I think that the logic in part was that he's speaking about an issue that directly to the public that affects hundreds of thousands of federal employees and millions of American citizens who are affected by the shutdown of many government agencies. There's going to be a Democratic response. We've apparently covered every live Oval Office address since the year, I think, 2001 by a president, and they wanted to keep on doing it. And that's, you know, there is this tradition of broadcast networks of saying if there's a formal request from the president, we will almost always grant it, and that we are, you know, you're seeing media executives ultimately, even on what was described as a borderline case, fall into this is the way we've done it in the past. The difference is, of course, this is a president whose manner of public rhetoric and his relationship with the truth is different in some ways than almost any president we've ever had in the past. And so it is, you know, uncomfortable reconciling past conventional practices journalistically with an incredibly different dynamic that's playing out right in front of your eyes if you cover it on live TV and that or live broadcast. And that's the tension there. I do think the Democratic response allows broadcast executives to say we are not going to allow this to be totally unmediated or unresponded to. And, you know, the better news organizations are going to sandwich what he has to say with preparatory analysis and you know, shall you, you know, in the sports analogy, post-game show, right?
Yeah.
That looks at the X's and O's. But I think it is a problem that media executives don't want to talk about publicly. And, you know, there are two other things, one of which is if this were happening on one of the more popular days of the week for network TV shows, it would be a much harder call for them to say yes because they don't want to drop their most profitable shows.
Yeah, like Thursday night.
And that does
night.
Come into play, yeah. Right? And the second thing is that network news executives can read the polls too. And they know if they were to deny the president this, that it would be another talking point, another stick with which he would beat the media and his surrogates and colleagues at the White House and, you know, Fox News and Sinclair and other places would beat up the media for being unfair to this president. The only caveat is they'll do that anyway. So, that can't really be a factor, but it is a factor, I promise you, in how media executives think about this. They are very much aware of how the public perceives some of their critical coverage, particularly of this president. And, you know, it all plays out on social media, and they follow that very closely, too.
David Folkenflik, always a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us today on Air Talk.
You bet.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik with us on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we're going to talk about progressive Democrats who've been elected to the House, their call for a Green New Deal. And one of the provisions of that to help fund a number of the programs that are part of the Green New Deal is a 70% federal income tax on income above $10 million a year. We'll talk about how that might play out in overall tax revenue and in the economy. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. We're going to talk about the proposal of a 70% tax hike on income above $10 million a year. This proposal part of the Green New Deal that new member of Congress Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is touting to fund a number of progressive initiatives that are in the Green New Deal. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez sat down with Anderson Cooper in a 60 Minutes interview on Sunday night, and Cooper asked the new member of Congress about the specific tax rate increase.
You look at our tax rates back in the 60s, and when you have a progressive tax rate system, your tax rate, you know, let's say from zero to $75,000 may be 10% or 15%, et cetera. But once you get to like the tippy tops, on your 10 millionth dollar, sometimes you see tax rates as high as 60 or 70%. That doesn't mean all $10 million are taxed at an extremely high rate, but it means that as you climb up this ladder, you should be contributing more.
Just an important point, though, even with those much higher tax rates, historically so much was deductible that few, if any, people paid at those tax rates, including the very wealthy. With us to talk about the proposal is Kyle Pomerleau, who's economist and director of federal projects at the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation. Mr. Pomerleau, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, share with us if this were to pass and you were to have a 70% federal tax rate on income above $10 million a year, how do you think that would affect overall tax revenue? Would it generate the kinds of collections that would fund some of the programs included in the Green New Deal?
Yeah, I think it's very important to sort of set a base here of understanding of what sort of revenue to expect. And I think that this would end up raising very little revenue, and two principal reasons. One, with very high marginal tax rates, the returns to tax planning and tax avoidance go up. 70%, which is what she's proposed, means that for every dollar I shelter or someone very wealthy can shelter, that's a 70-cent savings. So the incentive there is much higher. You know, under current law, maybe it's not worth hiring that accountant to help you hide some of your income, but when the returns are 70 cents on the dollar, then it becomes worth it, and we'll see avoidance go up. So that's one reason. The second reason is about 46% of all of that income above $10 million is capital gains income. And under current law, capital gains are only taxable upon realizations. So when the rate goes up from the current 20% to potentially 70%, individuals will respond by simply not realizing gains. And we have good evidence that this is the case. A lot of academics have found that, for example, when the tax rate goes up by 10%, realizations go down by about 7%. So the effect is pretty significant. So on net, I'm thinking that this is not going to raise very much revenue.
Well, you mentioned about the 70% in high state income tax states like California and New York. You add on the state income tax at the highest level beyond that. I don't know, you're probably looking at close to 80% taxation total.
That's correct, that there are state and local taxes to consider, and the marginal take above that $10 million would be pretty significant.
Now, what about deferring compensation? Is that, I'm thinking of now, professional athletes are by no means the majority of $10 million plus earners, but if you have an athlete, let's say, who would otherwise get $15 million a year in compensation, could that athlete just defer the additional $5 million until post-career to avoid exposure to the tax?
Yeah, I think accountants would come up with a lot of clever ways to reduce taxable income when the rates are that high, whether it's deferring compensation or setting up personal corporations in which individuals earn through the corporation rather as an individual, bringing the rate down to 21%. There's a whole litany of things that could be done for individuals above that range to reduce the hit.
We're talking with Kyle Pomerleau of the Tax Foundation. He oversees the center's research. Also with us, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times, Michael Hiltzik. He's author of The Plot Against Social Security, How the Bush Plan's Endangering Our Financial Future. And he's recently written in the Times about the tax proposal from Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. Michael Hiltzik, good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
It's good to be back.
So what are your thoughts? How do you think a tax rate like this on income above $10 million would affect overall revenues?
Well, so I think what Kyle was just saying, most of that, if not all of it, is accurate. But I think that's the beginning of the conversation, not the end of it. I mean, one other factor that he didn't mention is that when we talk about taxpayers with annual income over $10 million, we're not talking about a lot of people. We're talking about something in the neighborhood of 16,000 tax returns out of 150 million. So it's not a lot, but once again, I think what we really are talking about is a much fairer and much more progressive tax system than we have evolved into. And when Kyle talks about how, well, you know, when you have these high rates, you are basically incentivizing tax avoidance. Well, the answer to that is to enforce the tax law and make sure that tax shelters that are promoted for the ultra-wealthy people are legal and aren't done simply to avoid tax. And what we have seen in the last few years is that IRS enforcement has dropped through the floor because the agency hasn't been funded for enforcement, for the very reason that Republicans in Congress, mostly Republicans, don't want their patrons to be facing a lot of tax problems. So they've essentially cratered the IRS's ability to enforce. So, yeah, you know, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talks about raising the taxes to 70% on people earning more than $10 million, that's a very conservative proposal in historical context. We used to have 70% taxes on people earning $200,000, which in inflation terms is more like $1 million, not $10 million. And of course, in the Eisenhower years and the early Kennedy years, we had marginal tax rates as high as 91%. So she's not really recommending anything that's socialist or radical or anything like that. But she is, I think, offering the start of a discussion that we need to have on how the wealthy can be made to pay their fair share, and they are not doing so.
But just clarify on the historical framework, isn't it fair to say that back at the time there were those historically high tax rates, you know, virtually everything was deductible as a business expense? There was so much that was deductible that functionally that tax rate didn't in reality exist.
Well, I don't think that wealthier taxpayers pay the top marginal rate today. I think there's a lot that's deductible. And, of course, as Kyle alluded to, the fact is that when you get to the level of people who are earning $1 million, $5 million, $10 million, something in the neighborhood of half of those earnings are capital gains, and they're taxed at just 20%. So, yeah, you would see, I think, a lot of attempts to reclassify ordinary income as capital gains or dividends. And once again, you need the IRS to ride herd on that sort of behavior very much. So look, the wealthy don't pay the rates that they claim to be paying even today. They didn't pay it then. They're never going to pay it because there always are going to be deductions because they've got a strong lobby, and they're going to get what they want. And once again, the one thing that they want, the tax break that they will die on the hill for, is the capital gains preference. And there's a good argument for removing that.
I want to thank you both for being with us. That's business columnist for the LA Times, Michael Hiltzik, whose most recent piece looks at the tax proposals from Democratic Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez of New York and Kyle Pomerleau of the Tax Foundation. You can share your comments about the proposal for a 70% federal tax rate on income above $10 million a year on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, we'll talk about portrayals of the Jewish characters and Jewish culture in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the Amazon Prime streaming series, now in its second season, back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Hurdies. Such pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope things are going well for you today. Quick programming reminder, we'll have NPR's live coverage of President Trump's address to the nation this afternoon, I should say this evening, 6 o'clock, right here on KPCC, immediately followed by the Democratic leadership response from Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, Speaker of the House and Democratic leader of the Senate, respectively. We'll hear their immediate live response to the live address to the nation by the president. That's 6 this evening, right here on 89.3 KPCC. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, an Amazon Prime streaming series, has received a great deal of love from viewers and from critics. And even in the Golden Globes Sunday night, the star who plays Mrs. Maisel, Rachel Brosnahan, took home the Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Comedy Series. Brosnahan plays Miriam Midge Maisel, a Jewish budding comedian in late 1950s Manhattan. The Amazon show has Jewish characters in abundance, including Mrs. Maisel, and also pokes fun at Jewish culture in various ways, familially, religiously, and otherwise, over the course of the series. Let's listen to this clip from the first season, which takes place at a wedding reception as Midge Maisel is herself offering a toast to her marriage.
This day is perfect. It's like a dream. Or a nightmare, if you're my father. How much for the flowers? Who eats mushroom caps? Do the caterers have any idea what the Jews just went through a few years ago?
Two cakes, one for eating.
We're very happy.
But this day has been long in planning. Anyone who knows me knows I plan. At 6, I decided Russian literature would be my major. At 12, I found my signature haircut. At 13, I announced I was going to Bryn Mawr College.
In Katherine Hepburn's old room.
I have wonderful parents. I've had a very comfortable life, and though I knew that love would be great, I had no idea it would be anything that could justify what I paid for this dress.
What I paid for that dress. We're very happy.
And because it's better than anything I could have imagined, I thought I should get up here today and tell all of you that I love this man. And yes, there is shrimp in the egg rolls.
Miriam!
That from the marvelous Mrs. Maisel from the first season. The second season, 10 episodes, are also available on Amazon Prime. And the Los Angeles Times, former Times TV critic and currently magazine writer Paul Brownfield, wrote an essay titled Shticks, Stereotypes, and Self-Parody, How the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Gets Jewish Culture Wrong. Paul Brownfield, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Share with us what your biggest concerns are about how Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish family life is portrayed or even caricatured in the series.
Well, I think what I focused on in the piece that I did was the year that the show, certainly the second season, is set in, which is 1959. I mean, the comedy and the writing and the portrayal of the Jewish characters, I'm not arguing those people, you know, couldn't have existed, but it feels very sort of rooted in stereotypes of the past and earlier points of the 20th century. So it felt to me kind of false and also a missed opportunity because, you know, 1959 is a time of, you know, Philip Roth publishes Goodbye Columbus, Saul Bellow is, you know, published several novels. I don't know, I just felt like there's more to Jewish culture than this kind of, you know, borscht belt-y constant one-liners that every character, you know, says.
Now, you're Jewish, I think. I'm not, so maybe I respond to the series differently. But I think of the series as sort of, you know, sitcom caricature, and in that it's not just Jewish culture and Jewish family life, but it's academia is totally unrealistically portrayed and caricatured, including Tony Shalhoub's character of Abe at Columbia University, where he's a star math professor. Even New York, in a sense, is caricatured in how it's portrayed. The language isn't really representative of how people really talked in 1958 and 59. Is it fair to hold this series, which is by definition shticky, to a reality standard in the way it portrays Jewish culture?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, no. I mean, as you point out, it's a fantasy. And, you know, television in its, you know, what they call peak TV, still in its peak TV era, is taking on a lot of, you know, tough, dark, ugly subjects. And I understand that I'm raining on people's parade here. Here along comes a comedy, a fantasy. It's really beautifully produced, wonderful to look at. And I start bringing up, you know, issues with the way the Jewish characters are portrayed. But on the other hand, it's been on the air for 18 episodes, 18 hours. And I think, as I wrote in the article, it's, you know, those sorts of stereotypes. I'm a huge fan of Jewish comedy, but I don't know, of an 18-hour long, you know, bit. So I just felt like one, you know, all of these hours, it's kind of accruing and it becomes a chore to watch, frankly.
We're talking with Paul Brownfield, a former TV critic for the Los Angeles Times, magazine writer now. And he wrote a piece published in the Times very recently, Shticks, Stereotypes and Self-Parody, How the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Gets Jewish Culture Wrong. I'd love to hear from you, particularly if you are Jewish, what you think of the ways in which Jewish culture, family life, faith is portrayed in the comedy series. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Particularly if you're a fan of the series, how do you perceive of the Jewishness of the series, how that is portrayed? 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Paul, I was also wondering, a number of the actors who portray the Jewish characters are not themselves Jewish. Rachel Brosnahan, for example, is not. Tony Shalhoub, who plays her father, Abe, is not. There are some Jewish actors, Michael Zekin, who plays Joel, her estranged husband, Alex Borstein, who plays Susie, her manager, are. But does that matter to you at all?
Not really. I mean, I hate to get into counting, you know. I mean, the other thing I will say is it's a new experience for me. I mean, you mentioned earlier that I'm Jewish, and I'm a white Jewish male and, you know, a longtime TV viewer, and I'm not used to feeling, you know, sort of offense at my culture being parodied. I mean, that's something that the African-American community, the Latino community, the Asian-American community, you know, have had to deal with for a long time. So it took me a while to realize that I was insulted by the show, I guess is what I'm saying too. But I'm not insulted that I don't think like, oh, only Jews can play Jews. I mean, I think the sort of patter of the show and the way the characters are presented, you know, that's on the page and in the direction.
Now, the co-showrunner of the series, co-writer Amy Sherman Palladino, she herself is the daughter of a Borscht Belt-style Jewish comedian. That was what she was hoping to capture. Your sense of her defense wouldn't be the right word because she said this from the very beginning. So sort of her explanation for the context of the show and his characters.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand the conceit of the show. She's, you know, having, I mean, the entire voice of the show, even the non-Jewish characters on the show sound like Jews, quote unquote. So I understand what she's going for and the tone that she's going for. I guess I'm just saying 18 hours in, this Jew has sort of had enough.
All right. We'll continue with Paul Brownfield. And again, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this. You don't have to be Jewish to have an opinion on it, but I'm particularly interested in Jewish fans of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, or maybe you didn't become a fan because of how its Jewish characters, Jewish culture were depicted in the series, and it turned you off. I'd be interested in hearing. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk today. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to talk about what we expect to be a budget proposal of the new governor of California, Gavin Newsom. That is for 6 months of paid parental leave, both fathers and mothers having the opportunity to have extended time off to be with their child after birth. We'll talk about how that might be paid for and what the effects would be on employers as well as peer employees. That's in our second hour of Air Talk. Right now, we're talking about the Jewish characterizations and depiction of Jewish culture in the Amazon Prime streaming series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. With us, Paul Brownfield, former LA Times TV critic, who wrote a piece in the Times about Jewish culture in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and Brownfield saying that he doesn't think that it does an effective job of fairly portraying the culture and comedically in doing that. It just got tiresome. Marcia in North Hollywood, good to have you with us. Your thoughts about the series?
Well, I was in high school at the time the series is depicted, and I lived in the Bronx in New York, and my grandparents had a hotel up in the Catskills, and I spent every summer there up until the time I was in my late 20s. And I have to disagree. I think it's spot on. I mean, I knew those people, and none of us likes to think of ourselves as a stereotype, but, you know, people do stereotype for a reason, that people fall into categories. And I, you know, I've seen the series and especially was interested in season two because it depicted the whole area of the Catskills. And I think that they've done a marvelous job. You know, there are some problems with some of it. But I think basically they get it. They really get it.
Marcia, just out of curiosity, what was the hotel that your grandparents had, just in case any of our listeners stayed there when they were growing up?
Oh, well, it was called The Flower Hill, but it was near Grossinger's, and it was
near Grossinger's. Yeah.
Yeah.
The internationally famous Grossinger's in the Catskills. Marcia, thank you so much. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Amy in Echo Park, your opinion on the depiction of Jewish culture and characters in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Hi there. I really love it. I love the series. I understand that, you know, it is a bit of a caricature depiction, but it, you know, it's supposed to be comedy, so you know, it's lively, it's entertaining, it's a lot of dialogue, very quick. But what I really loved is that I'm half Jewish. I'm on my father's side. I'm Sephardic Jewish, so it's a Spanish Jew, but it's a similar culture. But you know, and I don't have a lot of relatives in LA. I have a few, and I love them, and I love being around them. But I didn't get immersed in the culture, and I didn't get to go. I only went to synagogue periodically.
Okay.
It was really a chance for me to, you know, to really explore it and love it and find my identity, you know, on screen of like, oh, I, you know,
yeah,
remembering all the people that I love and seeing that celebrated and seeing that the flaws of it. And it's just really fun for me.
Amy, hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I want to get some other folks into the conversation, too. That's Amy in Echo Park. Hillary in Santa Monica, I understand you're the daughter of Jack Rollins, who managed Woody Allen, Joan Rivers, other major Jewish comedians. What, you grow up in this world depicted in the series?
I'm sorry?
You grew up in the world depicted in this series?
Completely grew up in the world in the series, and from the day it came out, I had friends from all over the world contacting me and saying, "Hey, have you seen The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel? That's your life." And I have to say, I'm not trying to trash anyone's work. I am myself a writer. Kudos to the creators for writing the show and having a hit, but it is so clearly not realistic or, you know, authentic on any level. It just is so, I mean, my father gave, what's his name?
Woody Allen, were you going to mention, or someone else?
Say, Lenny Bruce. He got his first gig in New York.
Wow.
People that he knew, that I knew, that I had exposure to. And, you know, the show is eye candy, and it's a lot of fun, and I'm all for entertainment and fun, but I do have issues with how it depicts New York in the 50s and 60s, show business, and Jews.
So, Hillary, let me ask you, because Woody Allen, of course, parodies his childhood and Jewish New York culture in many of his films. Would you contrast Mrs. Maisel with how Woody Allen has done that?
I would, and I don't think that Woody gets a pass on everything either, but there are a lot of aspects of the two that are do contrast to me. One is that, you know, Woody is very much was creating that characterization from a very personal place, not sort of having it represent an entire world, but sort of just the mind of Woody Allen. He was doing so at a time when that really was fresh and not being seen as, you know, some kind of rehash of Jewish experience. And then on top of it all, I don't think that we've taken into account the fact that we live in a time when there's a whole, you know, movement of cultural identity politics. I'm not in any way saying that, you know, we should get all up in arms over any of this.
But you're saying you think the context is different for the series than how this humor might have been in the past. Hillary, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Rick in Long Beach. Go ahead, Paul Brown.
Oh, I just wanted to add on what Hillary
real briefly,
said.
I mean,
that was, you know, partly an inspiration for why I wrote the piece, which is that, yes, this is a time when we're looking at portrayals of, you know, races and ethnicities in pop culture with, you know, more of a microscope than we ever had. So why should any show be immune to that?
All right. I want to thank so many interesting and so many different opinions among Southern California Jewish listeners to Air Talk. Marlene in Sherman Oaks finds it insulting to her culture, says, I was married in 57 when Rachel was, and none of the show feels like me. But Joe writes on the page, my husband and I are Jewish fans of the show. We disagree with Mr. Brownfield's conclusions. Paul Brownfield, thank you so much for being with us. More to come in hour two of Air Talk on KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change, because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Such a pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Just quick programming reminder. You're going to hear back-to-back speeches this afternoon, this evening at 6 o'clock. NPR providing live coverage of President Trump's address to the nation, in which he's expected to make the case for significant funding toward a border wall, and the Democratic response from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Democratic Senate Leader Chuck Schumer. That's coming up this afternoon at 6 o'clock right here on 89.3 KPCC. Yesterday, if you were with us, you heard the swearing-in and the inaugural address of California's new governor, Gavin Newsom. Now, on full display as he was giving his speech is a family, and that being a central part of his initiatives. His son was up there on stage, a good portion of the speech with him, carrying his blanket as he went along. And Newsom is expected to make a number of proposals in his budget that are family friendly. One of the ones about which we have, you know, very few details or any confirmation beyond a New York Times story is that he's going to propose 6 months of paid family leave for prospective fathers and mothers. The question, of course, is how would that be paid for? Would it be some sort of an extension of the state's disability program into which employees and employers pay? Would it be more heavily carried by employers? Would there be other tax revenues that might be included in it? How would you fund that if you would be able to provide 6 months of paid leave? And would it be available to both parents the full 6 months? With us to talk about the potential in this, from the California Work and Family Coalition, the director of the organization, Jenya Cassidy. Jenya, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Share with us your thoughts on how this might be funded so that prospective parents would be able to spend 6 months with their babies.
Well, it's a very exciting announcement. We are really thrilled. And I think that the funding question, I don't know if everybody realizes, but right now we have paid family leave in California. We were one of the first states to ever establish a paid leave fund, and it was really exciting news back when that happened. Now we have states all over the country that are working on similar laws, and we have a big push for a federal law. So this is, for California, this is probably an easier question than it would be for a lot of other states because we have a very healthy SDI fund. However, I think with the governor, there's going to be, what I'm reading is there's going to be a task force. You know, the budget comes out this week, but there's going to be a lot of work between now and the May revise to really figure out and kind of learn more about what exactly the plan is. The good news is we have a lot of groups on the ground that have been working on expanding paid leave and, you know, working on this issue for over 10 years. So I think there's a lot of experience to draw from and a lot of great opportunities here.
Would you support both parents having the opportunity to take 6 months, or ideally would it be shared? What would you think would be the best way of doing that?
Well, I think having both parents have 6 months would be ideal. If you look at it, we are way behind other countries. A year is actually the norm in a lot of our European and Canadian counterparts around the world. So we're at the very, very bottom internationally when it comes to providing any kind of leave. We also think for the child's well-being, having that amount of time, also being able to bond with both parents equally, is so important for the health and well-being of children.
And would ideally, if a couple wanted to split it to where one parent takes 6 months and the other takes 6 months, so you'd have a full year of parental care, would that be an option as well in your ideal?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be ideal if it was limited to 6 months, that we would have both parents be able to take it. People do this now with the much less time that we have, 6 to 12 weeks, depending on, a lot of things. Parents do take turns taking it to extend the time that they have home with their child.
And do you think the best funding mechanism is to increase contributions to the state's disability fund as the way to do that? Or do you think that there are other better ways to pay for it?
Well, I think that in terms of increasing it, there's actually a lot of questions that go into that in terms of, you know, how much it would cost right now the state disability fund is completely employee funded. And so I think there would be questions about how much that would increase per person. But right now it's a very healthy fund. I feel like we have this great foundation. So whatever the next move is, we're starting from a pretty solid foundation. I do like the idea of what we call a social insurance, where everybody pays in and people have it there when they need it. And that's what SDI is. And I think that's a good model, whether it would just be increasing the fund the way we do now or increasing it some other way. Although there could be other options that are just starting to be looked at.
I assume in the other countries you're talking about, it's generally from tax revenues that they do that, because they're higher tax countries. So this is part of their larger social safety net generally?
Yeah, I think and it's a really nice way to do it, because if you think about it, everybody at some point in their life is going to need this. So it's actually kind of a way that everybody is supporting each other and supporting themselves.
I'd love to hear from our AirTalk listeners. What do you think about this? First of all, do you just support the concept generally of parents having 6 months off to be able to raise the child? And that would apply to both parents, not just to a mother, not just to a father. It would be both parents, regardless of gender. Do you support that concept? Secondly, if you do, how do you think would best be paid for? And if you're someone opposed to it, share with us the reasons why you think this is not in the best interests of the state or of employers. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us from the National Federation of Independent Business, California State Director John Kabatek. John, good to have you with us again.
Good to be with you again, Larry. Thank you.
What are your concerns about this from the employer perspective?
Well, first of all, we here at NFIB, we represent about 21,000 small businesses in California. We're heartened to hear Governor Newsom, you know, not only talk about the importance of family, but also mention the importance of supporting and protecting small businesses and jobs in his inaugural address yesterday. I know he also made it clear that policymakers shouldn't squander the state surplus and the reserves that are in place. The family leave policy that's before us, and again, the devil's in the details. There's still a lot to be figured out here and a lot unknown. But even as you noted, the New York Times did an article, and they asked this week, who will pay for it? And at the end of the day, we know it'll be small business owners and taxpayers. Policymakers need to be cautious of flying in the face of the governor's own priorities from yesterday's inaugural by, you know, number one, not putting small businesses at risk, and number two, not hurting our state economy. So it's important to point out, California already offers the most generous employee leave programs in the nation. Small businesses here face among the highest tax and regulatory costs in the nation. And it's also important to point out that even the Department of Labor study has shown that the majority of small businesses, about 80%, already offer their employees some form of comprehensive employee leave benefits. So those who can't do it, they can't afford it. And this is just, unfortunately, could be the law of unintended consequences if it's not done right.
Well, I also wonder about setting aside the costs of it. The impact, particularly on small companies, where you have an employee who could be gone as long as 6 months. In what ways could smaller employers be able to mitigate the negative effect of having the employee out that long?
Well, that's a very good question. Yeah, because of this mandate, you're going to have small business owners placed in a very difficult position, also facing potential liability if they're not able to adjust to this. So, you know, the adjustment is a very difficult thing, Larry, when you're talking about people who are going to be off for that extended period of time. It's a cost to a business. It's a training or retraining or engagement cost that small businesses can't bear. And again, what we also have found is that small businesses, they can be, if policymakers really wanted to do the right thing here and give small businesses the ability to offer more generous leave programs, they could really look at it by reforming our daily overtime. You know, California is one of the only three states that mandate both daily and weekly overtime. If this cost were reduced by conforming to federal law and only mandating weekly overtime, employers actually would have the ability to offer more paid leave and provide a more flexible schedule for working families. Unfortunately, this mandate would be one size fits all, as we at least initially see it, and that's a big constraint for small businesses who, unlike a large business like a Costco or a larger business, don't have the ability to absorb these costs when somebody's off for that period.
Again, I'd love to hear from listeners. If you are the owner of a small business, if you're someone who would likely take advantage of 6 months of paid parental leave, your thoughts about this, if you support it, how do you think it would best be paid for? How should the cost be most effectively shared or borne? And if you are an opponent of it, what are the reasons why you think this would not be good for California to enact? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also with us from the Milken Institute, managing economist Kevin Cloudon. Kevin, good to have you with us again.
Thanks very much, Larry, and a happy new year.
Thank you. Kevin, what do you think the effect might be of this on a larger economic basis for the state? Does it have an effect?
Well, it absolutely would have an effect. One of the biggest issues that California is actually facing, even beyond all of this, is demographic. California has actually been bleeding out in terms of out-migration, two main groups, one of which is lower-paid unskilled workers who found that it's easier to go and find jobs in Texas, other places that are creating those kinds of jobs. But the bigger one is that a lot of younger families have been leaving the state. Part of that's due to housing, but part of that is just because of the fact that it's more difficult, more expensive, more frustrating to be able to have kids in California. The cost of child care is high. It's available, but it's very high. So something like this could potentially have an impact on families making a decision, especially young families, to stick around in California where they might not otherwise.
All right. And what about the potential effect, particularly on small businesses? We just heard from John Kabatek. Larger businesses, they have more ability to move people around and cover when someone's out for a prolonged period of time. Smaller businesses, more of a challenge. What effect would you see it having on them?
Well, it would definitely raise some issues in terms of small businesses planning, because if you have a situation where somebody is going to be out for 6 months, it definitely raises some flags in terms of worrying about what's the sustainability of this person in the workforce. You know, if the employer has to cover part of the cost because there isn't enough in the state fund, or how, depending on how the legislation is written, it could raise an even larger issue. The 6 months is essentially sort of the outer threshold for having a temp worker and being able to work that, but the state would have to look at how do you deal with temporary workers who come in. It would also have to look at the fact that there might be inadvertent discrimination against prospective new parents, because if a small employer is going to look at it, they're going to have to look at if a father or mother-to-be is likely to have kids in the near future, and they're going to have to think, can I handle this person disappearing soon after they're hired? Are they good enough? Do I want to stick, you know, do I want to keep them around? And there, even though you can't legally do it, there might be some unintended pressure for new hires to hold off having kids for a little while just because of the hardship on the smaller business.
You anticipated my next question with that, Kevin, because I was going to say this could actually be a boon for older workers. If smaller businesses, as you say, are going to be leery of hiring younger people because of the length of time that they would potentially be gone if they have a child. And as you said, that's not legal to do that. But in certainly subtle ways, smaller businesses could give preference to older employees.
They absolutely could. And there's already patterns around the U.S., alone in California, where older employees are not getting the second glances that they deserve for a number of different positions. And they might be more likely to do so because people might say, hey, somebody who's in their 50s or early 60s who's planning to not retire and stick around for a while might be a good bet. The other possibility, interestingly enough, is if family leave is more common, then a number of older employees who are looking to just extend their career a little bit could find themselves in a position of being able to fill in at a number of these places. They will already have the training and the experience, and they can step in and fill a role for a few months where a position might not have otherwise been available.
We're talking with economist Kevin Cloudon of the Milken Institute in Santa Monica, John Kabatek, National Federation of Independent Business, and Jenya Cassidy, California Work and Family Coalition. They're one of the key groups involved in the passage of the 2002 California Paid Family Leave Insurance Program. Again, I'd really like to hear from you as an AirTalk listener, particularly your experience of how this would play out in the workplace, in family life. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Coming up later this hour on AirTalk, what's called the gap year that many students take, or at least some students take, between high school and college, a year where maybe they travel, they do some sort of a particular work to test out a field they might be interested in. Maybe it's some sort of volunteerism. Maybe it's some sort of missionary work that relates to their faith. The gap year is getting more and more support, even among elite colleges, where people typically attend right out of high school. We're going to talk about that and why some schools are actually looking at helping to fund gap years. That's later this hour on AirTalk. Right now, we're talking about parental gaps from the workplace, where both parents of the baby would be able to take off 6 months from work fully paid under a plan considered by new governor of California, Gavin Newsom. Now, the question would be how to pay for that, whether it be the same structure that exists for the current family leave program in California, whether there'd be a look at general tax revenues or the disability insurance program into which California workers and employers pay. Also, there's the issue of how smaller businesses deal with the challenge of having employees that would be out for 6 months at a time on parental leave. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let me share with you some listener comments. Let's see, Bobby in Korea wondering, well, how many times would a family be able to use the six-month benefit? And would it lead to fewer women being hired by employers? Well, it would be for both men and women. Both parents, regardless of gender, would be eligible to receive it. So I don't know so much whether it would be gender related where the discrimination would be seen, but perhaps age related when you have people of child bearing age or someone in a relationship or marriage with someone of a child bearing age where this could be an issue. Scott in Norco says, I'm a small business owner. It would be another ding against my staying in California and would have to be for both parents. Otherwise, it would increase the bias against women candidates for new jobs. And yes, my understanding is it is a gender-neutral proposal for both parents. Daniel in Westwood says they would just move to subcontracting to avoid paying the leave, even for state employees. That is a growing trend. And Gary from San Pedro says politicians and people who push this type of thing don't work 355 days a year like me. And when someone goes out on family leave, it puts an incredible strain on my business. It's a nice idea, but the idea of someone being out for 6 months is ridiculous. That's Gary in San Pedro. Let's talk with Janet in Irvine. You're on Air Talk.
Oh, hi, Larry. I immigrated from Canada in my 30s. And there, the paternity leave is a year. And actually, the employers that I worked for found it kind of helpful because you can really plan. Here in California, the leaves are so short that you just wind up scrambling to cover the work. You can't train anybody to do somebody's job in that short amount of time. But that was, a lot of companies used it as a chance to train new managers. Okay, you have this position for a year, and then when the mat leave is up, you have another trained person that you can use in the company, or maybe the person doesn't come back from their leave and you have someone already in place.
Janet, do you know if that policy is national in Canada or is that a provincial law?
That was national, the year.
Okay. Janet, thanks very much. I appreciate your being with us. John Kabatek of the National Federation of Independent Business, you want to respond to her observation?
Well, I appreciate that. You know, a little bit of comparing apples to oranges, but I know that, again, thinking back to California and looking to our extremely generous leave program that's already in place, you know, we do already offer 6 weeks of partly paid leave and additional 6 weeks of disability for birth parents. And, again, we have a program here that is extremely aggressive. I think what we're trying to say basically is, I know that Kevin had spoken a little bit about this policy being able to keep employees and workers from leaving the state. But even Governor Newsom has traveled to Texas and other states to take a look at why we have been losing small businesses and businesses to other states. The concern is, as one of your recent callers or previous callers said, is, you know, this is another ding to a small business. It's another death by a thousand cuts when we again have one of the most generous, if not the most generous, employee leave benefit programs in the country.
If this was national, and that's sort of getting to the question that I had for our listener, if this was national, would it help deal with some of those issues, because there wouldn't be another state to flee to?
We'd have to take a very careful look at if this policy of the 6 months was national.
Yeah.
And I think small businesses across the nation right now are needing the ability to have more chance to expand and to grow. They're still in a position where they're in that growth mode and trying to be able to get out of the hole that they're in. So it's not just a California issue, but even if this were national, this kind of a program is just aggressive for folks who are just still, not just in California, but nationally, trying to make sense of how things work. And again, I think if there is any discussion, again, it should be at the national level.
We're talking with John Kabatek, National Federation of Independent Business. Keith in Alta Loma asked, do small business owners have to pay for all of this? If a small business owner has to take paternity or maternity leave, who pays for that? Jenya Cassidy of the California Work and Family Coalition. Again, it's not clear how this would be paid for yet, but what about for business owners? Would they have any access to this under if it was the SDI, the disability fund that paid for this?
Yes, usually they would. And I think a lot of what's come up with the two speakers before is that maybe not understanding how our law works now, that businesses are not paying for it in the way that they might think, like they would pay for a paid sick day. This is actually employee paid and funded, the fund we have now. And I think that anything that we would build on would be something that everybody is equally paying small amounts into so that people can take it. So I don't see the cost to business, and especially small businesses have really been our allies in not only passing but expanding the leave law. And there have been studies that show that in the years since we passed paid leave, it has had no effect to a positive effect, especially on small businesses who can't always afford to create a fund of their own. So it's very important for small businesses to actually have this type of leave that we're all paying into and that we can all take when we need it, because it's something that they might not be able to offer, and now they can. And if we just leave it up to the businesses to decide to do it themselves, that just leads to inequity where we just don't have people, then, you know, people who are lucky enough to work for a certain business have it and other people don't. And we really want this to be something that low-income and high-income parents alike and children can benefit from.
Jenya, do you have any concerns that for some employers that are able to do it, they will move to use people under an independent contractor basis so they don't have to make the payments into this? It doesn't have to be provided? Or do you have any concern about that?
No, I really don't, because I don't think it'll necessarily work that way. And that's something that I think that Gavin Newsom and I think the team that he has working on this and the statewide coalition partners that have been working on this for years are very thoughtful about how to do this in a way that really benefits our community. And that does mean businesses, parents, children, everybody. We want this to be something that is really ultimately, it's a great boon. So I feel like a lot of thought is going to go into this, including how can people who are contractors, which we know a lot of people are contractors, even if they just drive for Uber or Lyft, right? They should be able to access this too. So how do we do that? I think that's going to be some of the questions that go into creating this policy.
And they can't access the current leave that's available through the SDI fund, can they?
Unless they opt in. So there are ways to opt in. And then for that, an independent contractor right now kind of has to weigh the cost, you know, versus the expense. It's not a super high amount that they're paying in, but, you know, it can be very helpful if they're planning to have a child or if they think they may need to be a caregiver in the near future.
And Jenya, do you have a sense of what the cost would be, the difference in cost from the current 6 weeks to doing 6 months of paid parental leave? Have there been estimates on what the annual cost of that would be?
Yes, I do not have a number off the top of my head, but we are starting to look at that because I think, you know, as the caller Janet earlier said from, I think, Irvine, that, you know, it's absolutely a great point that 6 months can actually be better and easier to do than 6 to 12 weeks, because I even have a friend who got her current job because she was hired on when somebody went on maternity leave. And then that whole company grew enough in that time that she was able to keep that job. And that was an entry point for her to, you know, kick off her career. So I think it can be a really positive thing to have that length of time. In terms of cost, this is something we're all paying into. So it really is figuring out how much more and maybe who else who isn't paying now would pay into it. But it really isn't something that would be a per person cost necessarily, where the business is like, oh, no, somebody's using it. Now I have to pay more. It would be more than maybe hiring a temporary person. But right. they wouldn't be paying that person's leave.
Jenya Cassidy of the California Work and Family Coalition. Let me go back to economist Kevin Cloudon of the Milken Institute. Kevin, you have any sense of what the cost difference would be to extend parental leave to 6 months?
Honestly, it depends dramatically on the terms. It's worth remembering right now that the leave that we're looking at is only 6 weeks functionally and not fully paid. Is if you're going to extend it to fully paid to 6 months, you're then looking at the fact that it's going to be a significant, you know, a 24-week as opposed to six. So you theory quadruple the cost, and then the terms are how much is it going to be in terms of full, you know, fully paid, partially paid. How is it going to be structured? So it could be, you know, in theory, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars of potential impact, depending on how it's structured. Now, that being said, obviously there's a system in place in terms of money being available that's collected right now from each individual, but California has the highest individual income taxes in the nation. And we're also at the peak of state revenues right now. If there is any downturn in the market, if there's any downturn in the economy, there are real questions of whether or not we have the long-term funding for this without doing a clear set-aside, not just depending on general revenue. So the cost could vary significantly. I wish I could give you a...
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You laid it out very well. Kevin, thank you as always. Appreciate your being with us.
My pleasure.
Kevin Cloudon, managing economist at the Milken Institute. He's also executive director of Milken's California Center and the Center for Regional Economics. My thanks to the National Federation of Independent Business, a state director here in California, John Kabatek, and also my thanks to Jenya Cassidy, director of the California Work and Family Coalition. They were one of the key groups in the passage of the California Paid Family Leave Insurance Program that's in effect now, passed back in 2002. Coming up in our next segment of Air Talk, the so-called gap year. Now you've even got some colleges and universities looking to help fund students taking a year between high school and college to do something else aside from starting college. What do you think about that? We'll get more of the details right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. We're into that season when there's all the talk about big movies and what's award-worthy. Of course, the Academy Awards, the biggest of them all. And every year, Film Week provides you with an Academy Award preview with all of our Film Week critics on stage. We show clips from all the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures. And we're doing it once again at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Sunday afternoon, February 17th. If you've never been to one of these events, I strongly encourage you to get your tickets now. If you've already been to it, I don't have to tell you. I'll just tell you where to get your tickets. Visit kpecc.org/in-person. Get your tickets now, Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at the Ace Hotel. All of our Film Week critics, it's our annual Academy Awards preview. I'm trying to recall, is it our 17th annual something? We're going to be at 20 years here coming up very, very soon. So we hope you join us for that special event. And also, speaking of film, Ben Stiller will be Terry Gross's guest on Fresh Air coming up in fewer than 20 minutes. He's directing the Showtime series Escape at Dannemora about the true life escape of two prisoners from a maximum security prison in New York. Ben Stiller with Terry Gross on Fresh Air coming up at noon here on KPECC. Well, gap years are something that some students have taken between high school and college, if they could afford it, to be able to see a different location, do volunteer work, maybe work for a year in a field that they're interested in to better know if that's what they want to study in school. It can be used in a lot of different ways. But the idea of a gap year isn't just that you'd be sitting around the house and watching streaming movies, but actually finding out more about yourself and your world during that year period of time. Now there are some colleges and universities who are so sold on the idea of a gap year between high school and college that they're actually helping to fund it for some of the students accepted for admission after that gap year. Florida State University, Tufts, Princeton, and most recently Duke University are looking at providing financial aid that students might need to postpone their actual start of their college education. With us from Oakland-based Global Citizen Year, founder and CEO of the Gap Year Organization, Abby Falick. Thank you for being with us, Abby.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, for those who are less familiar with a gap year, what is the range of the way in which graduating college high school students can use that year?
I have to start by actually saying that we dislike the term gap year because in many ways it's the opposite of what this year actually has the potential to be. So when we think about the metaphor of a gap, it suggests that there's a gaping hole or an absence between two stages of life. And when we approach this transition, we are on purpose and not by default. We can structure it in a way that actually becomes the most enriching part of a young person's educational journey. It can be a rite of passage when it's approached in a particular way.
All right. And so what's the range of the activities?
Well, there are all kinds of things that students do. At Global Citizen Year, we're pioneering a model that wraps instruction and education around real-world lived experience. So we're shaping young leaders in ways that the world needs most through our core fellowship. So each year we recruit and select a really exceptional group of diverse young people from across America and around the world to participate in a 10-month leadership accelerator that includes immersion experiences in a community in Africa, Latin America, or Asia. They get training, coaching, and then they're launched into college and careers with a new sense of who they are and a perspective on the problems that they actually care most about solving. Beyond Global Citizen Year, our core approach, we're using what we're learning to influence a broader shift in how we think about what's possible in this year. We encourage colleges to have a perspective on what type of year they actually are most interested in supporting and encouraging. And for us, that's about making sure that you're leaving your comfort zone, that the experience somehow is purposeful and practical and in the service of other people, that there's some balance of autonomy and mentorship. And so it's not just sort of another box you check and a pre-programmed, pre-packaged kind of experience. And then ultimately that it's accessible to young people from all backgrounds. Historically, these types of experiences have been reserved for young people coming from privileged backgrounds. And we're really on a mission to make sure that this kind of experience can become the norm, not the exception, and to make sure that it's accessible to kids independent of their family's finances.
One of the things I see, and you know, admittedly, this is of kids who come from more economic means to where they're able to do more international travel, is I find that at least among young urban Americans, many of them are much more familiar with international locations and cultures than they are with the breadth of American culture, that really the whole in sort of the understanding is about the diversity within America itself. They know urban America, but they don't really understand the two-thirds of America that isn't urban. And I wonder, is there any place for that in your program to better understand what rural America, other parts of the country are like beyond the big cities?
I couldn't agree more. And for me, the premise is leave your comfort zone. Get to know a community that's very different from your own, that challenges your worldview, that helps shape your identity, that changes your perspective on who you are and who you're becoming. At Global Citizen Year, we're very focused on developing and launching a new generation of globally oriented leaders. So we're providing young people with the opportunity to live and work in other parts of the world as a way of becoming even more engaged citizens and leaders over the course of their lifetime. But we often field interest from young people who are looking to do something domestically. And whether it's through AmeriCorps or City Year, there are other opportunities for young people interested in a pre-college year to do domestic exchanges that allow them to broaden their perspective within America.
We're talking with Abby Falick, who's the founder and CEO of Global Citizen Year, an Oakland-based gap year nonprofit organization. Also with us is Christoph Gutentag, who is undergraduate admissions dean at Duke University, Duke, one of the schools that most recently is looking to provide financial aid for students who take that year to do something before college and after high school. Christoph, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Why has Duke taken this as one of the priorities, one of the offerings for the students it's going to accept?
We've always seen the value of gap years for both the students and the community. And when we had the opportunity to help encourage students from a broader range of backgrounds to take a gap year, to be able to afford a gap year, that just seemed like a great benefit to us and a great benefit to them. So we were really pleased at the opportunity to provide some financial aid and to give students choices about which kind of gap year they wanted to have, what they wanted to do during that bridge year, which some people call it, between high school and college. college. And we were thrilled at the way it would benefit them and the way it would benefit us when they become part of the community.
And what sorts of financial aid are you offering for, I'm assuming these are students you're accepting as freshmen at Duke, and then you're helping them to pay for this year before they start?
Exactly right. It's their responsibility to discover what kind of program they're most interested in, and then they have the opportunity to apply for funding from us, a minimum grant of $5,000, a maximum grant of $15,000, and we want them to tell us how that funding would allow them to do something different, more than they would otherwise be able to do. So we really want to encourage students who might not otherwise think of a gap year to think actively about it and to give themselves that opportunity.
And what are the range of applicants either you're getting or you expect to get, and the Duke would be open to funding?
Well, yeah, I think that one of the things that we do on our – we have a website for our program, and we give students examples of the kinds of programs. It could be anything, and I want to echo what Abby said about the value the value of leaving a comfort zone, the value of self-sufficiency, of changing a perspective. So it might be volunteering with a non-governmental organization. It could be working. It could be apprenticing even in a manual, you know, a manual labor opportunity, whether that's boat building. I mean, you know, the imagination of current students who are graduating from high school is really a thing to see, and we're so impressed by these students. So we're looking to see what they're interested in and allow that to drive what they do in that year.
And you're not looking at this to necessarily supplant Duke study abroad programs, right? This wouldn't be in lieu of that.
Correct.
Okay.
Study abroad is something that they'll do while they're here. This is really a growth opportunity and a service opportunity for them before they get to college, which the evidence suggests will make them better college students.
I'd love to hear from listeners if you're someone who took a so-called gap or bridge year or however you'd like to describe it. If you took a year to do something else between high school and college, and it was intentional, not just you sort of fell into it, but you planned to do that. You had an idea that you carried out for that year. I'd like to hear what you thought about that and the pros and cons, because I assume, as always, there's some degree of trade-off in delaying the start of your college experience by a year. I'd like to hear about it, how it worked for you in your life. 866-893-KPECC. Maybe your daughter or son did this coming out of high school. What did the experience seem like for you? The benefits or any drawbacks of taking that year between high school and college to be involved in some other activity? 866-893-5722. Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. Some call them gap years, other bridge years. They're special years taken between high school and college for students to do something else, whether it's travel, whether it's a particular kind of a volunteer project, whether it's missionary work for someone's a person of faith and wants to express their faith in that way between high school and college. If you've done so or your child has done so after high school, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about it, what you think of as the pros and cons. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Just a quick programming reminder, this evening at 6 o'clock, right here on KPECC, we'll bring you NPR's live coverage of President Trump's address on the government shutdown and his call for funding for a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Immediately following, we will have the Democratic response from Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. It'll be a joint response by the two Democratic leaders of Congress. You'll hear those speeches back-to-back from NPR, along with NPR's analysis right here on 89.3 KPECC this evening. evening at 6 o'clock our time. Let's talk with Lisa in Tustin. Lisa, I understand your daughter took a year between high school and college. What was her experience of that?
Well, she did really well in high school, took all the right classes, got all the right grades, went and applied to a lot of schools just like her friends did. But when she finally decided, had to make her decision to go to college, she really wasn't inspired. And I encouraged her to take a year off, a gap year, which kind of gave her a bit of anxiety, but she did it. And as a parent, I saw it tremendously beneficial. She got a full-time job. She learned how to be an adult and save money, make money. She volunteered for the National Park Service and because that's what she was interested in, environmental issues and what have you. And financially, when it came to the point where she was going to reapply to school the following year, she doubled her scholarships for what was offered. And schools that did not accept her before were interested in her. So financially, it was positive for us. As a growth experience, it was fantastic for her. And in the end, she knew more about what she wanted to do for her career and her goals in college. So,
Lisa, I appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your daughter's positive experience. Christoph Gutentag of Duke University Undergraduate Admissions Dean, there is another financial part of this we haven't talked about, and that is for the student who has a very clear sense of where she or he wants to go professionally. There is a cost to graduating college a year later. If graduate school is in the picture, delaying graduate school by a year, that means you essentially lose a year of the higher income one would have in a lifetime. So that is something to consider, right?
I think that makes sense. At the same time, I think that it's really difficult to predict 30, 40, 50 years out how long someone's going to work, what kind of opportunities they're going to have. So I think that analysis isn't wrong, but it assumes that a lot of things are going to be fixed. And frankly, I think that the value of taking a year between high school and college in terms of the kinds of decisions students make, the way they benefit from college, I think a richer college experience can lead to benefits that would outweigh that one year that a student has taken that theoretically could have been a year of earning.
Yeah, and the other side of it too is that year might be something that when someone's getting the first job really stands out, gets them hired sooner than someone else. So
I think it's a year of experience that a lot of people would recognize in a lot of different ways as being terrifically valuable.
All right, Lisa, I appreciate it very much. Rafe in Westwood, good to have you with us. You took your gap year in Israel, I understand?
Yeah, that's right. I was 18 and I was having some issues with being mature enough or thinking I was mature enough for college. And my parents had actually offered my brother to send him to Israel in that situation. But he didn't do it, so I said, well, why don't I? And I went to this yeshiva program in Ein Surim, which is about 15 miles or so from Ashkelon on the coast. And it was like 20 guys from abroad, maybe another 40 guys from Israel who were doing it as a pre-military experience. And basically, if you wanted to sleep in, they would just tell you, like, look, you're wasting your parents' money and your own time, and you should be embarrassed. But, like, they wouldn't make you do anything. And on the other hand, you could have classes from 6:30 a.m. to 10:30 p.m.
But you felt that this really aided in your personal development.
Yeah, I mean, it made me realize that, like, my time was for me and that the person who would get the most out of my work is me. And those are skills that allowed me to succeed in college that if I'd just gone straight from high school, I would have been developing them while in college.
Rafe, I appreciate that. Thank you. Rafe in Westwood. Derek in Port Hueneme said, I took a three-year break partially because I wanted to be able to surf as part of my lifestyle. It was really good that I didn't go to college immediately. I traveled. I got into environmental issues and then ended up going back to school for my degree. Sarah in North Hollywood says, I took more than a year off. I teach a community college. A lot of my students aren't college ready, and they drop out from the pressure. So I actually recommend them taking time to mature before that time. Yeah, my wife took off 2 or 3 years after high school. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do. She worked full time. She got a better sense of herself, what she wanted to do, and then started at community college, transferred from there, ended up getting her master's degree and going into speech pathology as her field. But you know, she said she just wasn't really ready after high school to go right into higher education. And I'm sure there are others who share that perspective. My thanks to Christoph Gutentag of Duke University Undergraduate Admissions Dean, where they're actually providing some financial aid to students taking that year between high school and college, and to Abby Fallick of Global Citizen Year. From all of us at AirTalk, have a great afternoon.